legislation. We now have before us Senate Bill 1067. Candace Yearsley, welcome to the committee, Candace. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to see you, too. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Candy Yearsley, and I am the Child Support Director for the State of Idaho Child Support Program within the Division of Welfare, and I am here to present Senate Bill 1067 relating to the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. On September 18, 2014, Congress passed the Prevent Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act, and this act included a requirement for all states to enact the 2008 amendments to the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, also known as UIFSA, during the 2015 legislative session. These amendments incorporate provisions of the 2007 Hague Convention on International Recovery of Child Support and Family Maintenance, and are intended to improve the enforcement of American child support orders abroad. In addition, these amendments include some minor technical correction and changes to reflect advancements in technology that can be utilized to increase access to the courts. UIFSA 2008 constitutes a limited revision of the Act. It defines a definition of record allowing for electronic transmission of testimony and allows telephonic or other electronic testimony for non-resident parties. Other changes include replacing under oath with under penalty of perjury for documents and affidavits, and allowing the Child Support Enforcement Program to redirect payments of orders when no party resides in the issuing state. With regard to international casework, it is designed to integrate the convention into state law by adding the term foreign country. In prior versions of UIFSA, foreign countries were equated with states. Finally, sections 46 through 59 of the amendment constitute a standalone procedure to direct a tribunal of this state on the do's and don'ts unique to convention support orders and is only applicable under the convention. All 50 states must enact UIFSA 2008 in a verbatim manner for the United States to participate and obtain the benefits of the Hague Convention. Currently, 32 other countries have ratified. This amendment is required for continued receipt of federal funds supporting the Child Support Program, which is required under the TANF block grant. The amendment is designed to help children residing in Idaho receive the financial support due from parents wherever their parents may reside. These amendments were drafted and are endorsed by the Uniform Law Commission, and I have worked closely with an Idaho member of the Law Commission to ensure that Idaho is aligning with those requirements. The members of the Law Commission in Idaho include Mike Brassi, Senator Davis, Rex Blackburn, and Dale Higer, who I've worked closely with. I ask you to send Senate Bill 1067 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I stand for questions.
Questions for Candace. Senator Tibbetts.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Excuse me, Candy. I appreciate what we're doing here. But frankly, it gave me a greater comfort level when you mentioned that the Uniform Law Commission has been involved with this. But as I read through here, it makes me a little bit nervous. The number of times that we mandate that tribunals in this state shall do something. Now, there's a lot of language, too, that just allows an option that's permissive, not mandatory. But let me turn to a couple of these examples, and maybe you can help me feel more comfortable about this. So let's go to page 11. And some of these mandates may seem relatively minor, but again, I just need a higher comfort level that when we say that a court in this state is going to be required to do something based on what a court in another country does, it makes me a little nervous. So let's start with towards the end of line 33, we're referring to the tribunal of this state shall specify the amount of the support sought, convert that amount into the equivalent amount in the foreign currency, so forth. And let's go down now to the middle of line 36, and provide any other documents necessary to satisfy the requirements of the responding foreign tribunal. So the court in another country is going to request documents, and we're mandating, I think, that our court here has to provide those documents. So maybe the rest of the committee will say, well, that's not a big deal, but again, I'd like to feel more comfortable about that. Let's turn over to page 19 now. on something similar. Frankly, there's quite a few of these in here. I'm going to just point out a couple of those that maybe create the most angst in me. So now I'm looking at page 19, line 48. Except as otherwise provided in this chapter, a tribunal of this state shall recognize and enforce, but may not modify, a registered support order if the issuing tribunal has jurisdiction. And as we go down through this page, there are other examples. But I think I'm going to stop right there and let you address for me this need for us to put mandatory language and requirements on our courts in this state, sometimes as it relates to a mandate from a court in another country.
Candy.
Madam Chair, Senator Tibbetts, a lot of the information that's in here, and I'm trying to find whether it says new section or whether it was what was part of UFSA 2001, which was already passed in the state. A lot of that verbiage was already passed. Some of it is in new sections. However, what they're trying to do here is they're trying to create the environment, because so many parents work out of the country, they're trying to create the same environment we have with other states. These are no different than the UFSA laws in the state of currently in the states, between states. What they're trying to do is, because so many parents are working abroad, they're trying to make sure that parents working abroad are still required to pay their support. So we provide the documentation based on where the parents are residing. It's pretty much what we do now with states. It's just now allowing us to do it with foreign countries.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tibbetts.
Yes, and Candy, you make the point that a lot of this language is existing language, and that's true. And it's existing language that applies to, excuse me, to other courts within this country. Mm-hmm. But now by referring to other countries, we're saying the rules that used to apply within this country now apply to foreign countries. And so instead of mandating, for example, that we're complying with a mandate from a court in another state, now we're saying that we're mandating compliance with some mandate in another country. And so even though the language is existing, we're broadening that, and that's what causes me the concern.
Candy.
Madam Chair, Senator Tibbetts, currently, as I stated in my presentation, we look at foreign countries as other states. So if there is an agreement between the United States and a foreign country based on child support, then we were treating those foreign countries as they were just another state. I believe what this is trying to do is say foreign countries needed to be treated as foreign countries, not as other states, just making it clear. But the process for the child support program has not changed.
No, Tibbetts, okay.
I'll defer for now, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Davis?
Madam Chairman, in an effort to help the question, obviously I'm familiar with the bill. I hate this bill. And I'm voting for it. I just don't like this being under the thumb of the federal government on historic state issues. And it really is just moving around chairs. You look at the definition of a state, and it is a foreign country. And then it has some standards associated with it. But a failure to enact this is not just the traditional saber-rattling by the federal government. If you don't do this, we won't do that. And then sometimes they follow through and sometimes they don't. This is something that very candidly is something that we should be concerned about. In the olden days, when I first started to practice law, here's how a divorce action happened. Husband and wife got a divorce. Husband agreed to pay $70 to $80 per month per child, and the husband wouldn't pay the child support. And a year or two would go by, the custodial parent, usually the mother, was now owed thousands of dollars, and she had no mechanism to collect the child support other than to go to the attorney that she still owed money to for the divorce and ask him or her to help. And usually it was done by a request of the court to issue an order to show cause to compel them to appear in court and show just cause why they shouldn't be held in contempt of court for not paying their child support. And guess who was making money in that proceeding? And it was frankly a lousy way to run a railroad. And so over the last many years, frankly, to the credit of our federal government, and with the significant efforts of the Department of Health and Welfare, they put together these methods of helping to collect child support. So today, I don't know what the numbers are today compared to 1,000 years ago when I started to practice, but in most instances, the custodial parent is getting child support, or they've got the department giving them the business, and they've got methods today of attaching tax refunds that didn't exist from before, and they do a pretty good job. Additionally, it used to be that to increase child support, you had to show a permanent material increase or change in circumstances. I haven't practiced law in this area for a long time, so if I've got the language wrong, I apologize. But this is in horseshoes, this is pretty close. I'm at least leaning against the pole, if not right around it. And so to increase child support even by a modest amount required, you had to hire an attorney. Well, the processes today are in place to avoid that. And long before I showed up here, the legislature made a decision to get out of the fights over child support. Because as long as we were drawing lines and choosing winners and losers. And so whoever the constituent was at home that was the most angry over a child support order that annoyed you enough, caused you to introduce bills, and we spent time here in this committee, at least our predecessors did, wrestling with what to do. And so even the guidelines on it are something that we have chosen intentionally as a legislature to stay out of. And that last comment is just so that those of you who stay longer than I have that reasoning and thought process behind it. When you look at the word jurisdiction, that's an important legal term. The Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act, which is a completely different statute than when I went to law school, we actually picked up an extra letter in there since I was there in school. But it is a very difficult issue to know which jurisdiction has jurisdiction. If you have two people today in Idaho Falls, and they've been there for a long time, then you'd think very candidly that a magistrate judge in Bonneville County might have jurisdiction, yet they may have been divorced in Saskatchewan or the like. And so how those courts have wrestled with this and tried to provide a uniform system. So whether you're going from Tennessee to Idaho or from British Columbia to Idaho, that there is a method of uniformity and policy. The more you provide for aberrations, the more difficult it is for us to do what we need to do, and that is make sure that non-custodial spouses, those rascals that need to be given the business, and most don't, not in today's world, but many need to be given the business. And so the purpose here is to try and say, this is a streamlined way so we enhance efficiency. And unfortunately now Congress is even tightening the screw down even more, saying, well, now all the commas have to line up. Well, come on, guys. I know, you're not the guys. You know who I'm troubled with. And frankly, a lot of the uniform law commissioners didn't like being in the spot that they were in, but because it was our act, we said, all right, we'll find a way to line the commas up in a more thoughtful way, being sensitive to this treaty that's out there, and do the best that we can. And so that's what you have in front of you. It's not, to at least to us, it's not new policy. It's not new methodologies. It is, if we do this, we ensure the funding that the department needs in order to be able to make sure that those dollars get from the non-custodial spouse to the custodial spouse. I hope that that was helpful to some on the committee.
Senator Burgoyne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Candy, in about 1979, I collected child support. I understand what you're trying to do. I'm favorably disposed to the bill, but like Senator Davis, I have a lot of heartburn, and I suspect that you have a lot of heartburn. But there is something that I'm looking for from you or whoever can help me here, and that is, I believe unquestionably in the modern world, we have friends, business associates, people we know well who go to places like China and have children there and come home to have those children because they want them born in the United States, or they have them there on the reliance that they're going to be U.S. citizens. And this just isn't the world that I grew up in. And I get that. And I understand that we've got to be able to enforce these obligations internationally. But I think that it's one thing, and I may be more comfortable than some because of that, about the statute saying that our judges will do this and our judges will do that. But it's one thing to tell them to enforce foreign orders. It's another thing to tell them to enforce foreign orders that are not just. To tell an American judge, to tell the American system of justice that, and by the way, I collected child support for people in Idaho, stretching from Alaska to Saudi Arabia. We got money out of Saudi Arabia. And so it's one thing to tell people in our system to enforce these valid foreign orders, but to expect us as Americans to enforce things against people who are in the United States when we view them as unjust strikes me as probably going too far in the name of this uniformity. And so what in this legislation keeps us from having to do that?
Candy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burgoyne, I'm not an attorney. I'll be the first to admit that. However, having done this for years and knowing the real changes that are coming from this, the thing that I see in this that's of real benefit to these customers, because we do have cases where they have an order from a foreign country and they're complaining about their foreign order, and the only thing they can do is travel to that foreign country to resolve any issues. With this change that they're making in this order, they would be able to do that electronically, by phone, not have to appear. And when we do orders within states, it's a similar thing. We have the UFO across states. However, if the person is disagreeing with the order, until that issue is resolved, and we know there's an issue that's being resolved, they've filed some type of documentation with the other state, or the other, we haven't had it with countries, but if they were filing something with another country, we're very mindful of that. So to say that it's a blanket policy of how it works, even today, if we send an order to another state or another country, and there's issues with their understanding of that, which many times we can't even get them translated, so we really can't enforce them. Some of those issues come up, and there's no, we can only do what we can do. And so I think the bottom line for this is it gives those people the opportunity to resolve their issues with that place where their issue is, because we can't do anything for them without having to actually travel there to do it. That's the greatest benefit I saw as I read all of this, because most of it is just change of words, as Senator Davis pointed out.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, so here's the other piece that concerns me. It'd be one thing to have this kind of an agreement and this kind of a statute to implement an international norm here with countries whose law and processes we respect. Obvious ones, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, European Union. Can you tell me, you know, not necessarily list all these countries, but I mean, do we have some outliers there? Are we going to be enforcing orders in the United States under this regime from China, from Russia, from Saudi Arabia, from Iran? What kinds of countries are involved in this international effort?
Candy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burgoyne, I don't know who is members of the Hague Convention, but I could certainly get that information for you. It has to be ratified by the countries of the Hague Convention, and that's the countries it appears to be limited to by the information that I've read, and I can certainly get you that information.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Tibbetts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. Candy, you said most of this is just change of words. I don't agree with that because we have a clear definition of state, and it says clearly, and this is, you can find this on page 5, state means a state of the United States or the District of Columbia and Indian tribes. And now we're adding a definition of a foreign country. And so isn't it true that many provisions in this bill in the past have applied only to states within the United States, and now, because of the convention, we're applying those same principles to foreign countries that are members of the convention. Is that accurate?
Ms. Yearsley?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tibbetts, no. In the past, the definition of states included foreign countries. So if the United States had a reciprocal with a foreign country, that foreign country was treated no different than we would treat Montana.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That helps. And I see now we have some stricken language that makes me feel more comfortable about that. Candace, would you look at page 20 with me now? And I'm looking, it's going to start on line 20, and this is another one of those provisions that causes me some heartburn, and I have the same concern that was expressed by Senator Burgoyne, that there's some countries that I can feel comfortable with, I guess, but I don't know who those countries are, and I worry about the ones that we wouldn't think have reasonable or fair or just laws. But line 20, and this is subsection 4, after a tribunal of this or any other state determines which is the controlling order and issues an order consolidating arrears, if any, a tribunal of this state shall, again that mandatory language, prospectively apply the law of the state or foreign country, prospectively apply the law of the state or foreign country issuing the controlling order. So now we're saying that our courts are going to apply the law of a foreign country, including its laws on interest, on arrears, on current and future support, and on consolidated arrears. So Candace, can you make me feel more comfortable about that? Because again, I'm comfortable, and this is that uncomfortable that we're requiring our judges to enforce laws of another country.
Seriously?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tibbetts, I would just go back to what I said earlier to Senator Burgoyne. I can get the list of countries that this entails because it is part of the Hague Convention. The countries involved in the Hague are the countries that are involved in this. However, I don't think this is a change. I wish I had the attorney with me. I don't think this is a changed portion. I don't think this is all new. Therefore, this wording was here before, and state included foreign country. And all they've done here is break foreign country out of the word state. So prior to this, if the United States has a reciprocal, which currently I can tell you that I know, there's no reciprocals with China. There's not even a reciprocal with Mexico. There's no reciprocal with Iraq or those countries. The reciprocals that I'm aware of course, Idaho does not have a large population of foreign country cases. We have, I would say, somewhere in the vicinity of a few hundred foreign country cases. The countries we work the most with are countries like Australia, the countries that you mentioned, Britain, Canada. So That's why I don't know the list of countries, but I am more than willing to provide you the list of the countries that are involved in The Hague.
Mr. Chairman, I think just one follow-up.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Candace. So I guess the other issue that I'd like a higher comfort level with is that all of the mandates in here, all the places we say shall, and there are a lot of them, and we have a lot of mays, too. There's a lot of permissive language, but there's a lot of mandatory language. Can you assure me that wherever we say shall, we have to have that mandatory language to comply with the convention and not put our federal funding in jeopardy?
Seriously?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tippetts, I can. The requirement of this piece of legislation was verbatim language. Every state has to have it the exact same. We weren't able to make any changes to the language as far as the language was written.
Thank you.
Senator Tippetts, follow-up? Senator Sousa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Candy, I was wondering if you could tell, you said, or someone, I don't know if it was Senator Davis or if it was you, alluded to the fact that we have to have this language as mandated by the federal government or we will lose funding. Is there some way you can tell me, as a new member of this committee, what kind of funding are we talking about?
Ms. Yearsley?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sousa, the funding for the child support program is part of the TANF block grant. The TANF block grant is the grant that provides the funding for all the benefit programs, I think excluding Medicaid, but the federal benefit program. So the requirement to have a child support program is part of that block grant. And so that block grant is what's in jeopardy, according to our federal partners, if in fact this legislation doesn't pass.
Follow up.
Thank you, Paul. Mr. Chairman, excuse Candy, I pulled up on my iPad the list of Hague countries, and Mexico is included. China is just Macau and Hong Kong, not the mainland of China. And there are a huge number of other countries, many of which I'm not sure if we would be comfortable with their laws and their methods and cultures. So I am concerned. Thank you.
Chairman, there's a difference between the convention and having agreed as a country to be bound by the terms of this particular provision. And in order for the United States or any state within the United States or any other country to look at the enforcement of it, those countries have to sign off on the terms of this international work product. And it does contain, and I'm not an expert on this, and so if the committee wants to have, I don't have the right to speak for the chairman or vice chairman, but if you want someone to come and speak about the due process standards that they have to agree to in order to be able to be eligible to participate in it, you know, that might be something worth understanding. But we, in that the other hat that I wear, there was a topic of more than casual conversation, because we couldn't agree more with what Senator Tippetts was saying and what Senator Burgoyne was saying. We're not interested in enforcing orders from rascal countries, but I do think it's important as well. And this isn't my bill. I mean, I don't know how I'm in the middle of this. I just want to be a committee member. But remember, merely because a foreign entity has entered an order doesn't mean that Idaho can't modify that order. As jurisdiction changes over time, in law school we're taught the difference between in rem jurisdiction and in personam jurisdiction. And I had hoped to never say those again after having taken and passed the bar. But a jurisdiction can have in rem jurisdiction, but they may not have actual jurisdiction over an issue. And that's why under a different act, when you look to determine whether a foreign body or Idaho has jurisdiction over a proceeding, you look, of course, at the old international shoe and minimum contact standards and the Volkswagen case and all of that. But in short, all it means is that a state can't just modify another state's determination without actually having some jurisdiction over it. So hypothetically, again, I'm going to use Canada just because I can say the provinces there and I can't say all the foreign country names correctly. But assume that I have a young man from Calgary go down to BYU in Provo, meet the love of his life from Boise, Idaho. They marry and they return to Canada and they start a family. Well, they have substantially similar notions of due process, and none of us are troubled by that. But then they get a divorce, and wife now wants to leave Calgary and return to Boise with the children. All right, who has the right to modify that what we would call a decree of divorce? The divorce was entered in Canada, not here in Idaho. Well, she left, he didn't, but the kids are here. Well, the UCCJEA balances that, and after a period of time, Idaho acquires more jurisdiction over some of the decision-making process. Initially, the policy is, because of a variety of reasons, initially, the policy is that you give deference to the jurisdiction that you both consented to be in and you consented to participate in the process. One of you left. Now, he's been disadvantaged because you took the kids and moved to Boise. Now, it may have been done with his permission or his consent or even with the court saying, I don't see a problem. This seems to be in the best interest of the children. I think you ought to go. But over time, our magistrate court acquires the ability by law to even reach into and modify the decrees of foreign jurisdictions, whether they be state or foreign countries. So when you look at this bill, and this isn't the UCCJEA, the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act, but if you go to page 23 of the bill, for instance, it says, notwithstanding subsections 1 through 5 of this section and section 7105B, Idaho Code, a tribunal of this state retains jurisdiction to modify an order issued by a tribunal of this state if, and then it parrots the language that we see in other Idaho provisions. And then go to the top of page 24, where it talks about the jurisdictional rights of our courts to then modify support orders of foreign countries or other foreign bodies. And so in the event that you have, if you can conjure up the ghosts that we all get in our mind on things like this, this gives to an Idaho magistrate judge the authority to step forward and say, now listen, we're not going to enforce crazy orders. And so far, Idaho, I think, has shown good judgment in that. So I throw that into the pot and the mix, but I hope that's helpful. It is to me.
Thank you, Senator. If I may... I appreciate your explanation a lot, because I had the very same question about if we were to receive an order that might not be constitutional in our state or country, and how that would apply. And I appreciate that explanation. I do have a question about the state's liability. Should we receive an order from a foreign country and we modify that order, would our state be liable financially or civilly in any way? And Candace, if you would like to yield that question to someone, I would.
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you how it works now, but if I'm more than willing to yield if he understands how it will work in the future.
Senator Davis, would you yield to that question?
Well, actually, Senator Burgoyne can probably do a better job than I can on this, but jurisdictional fights between bodies happen all the time. And sometimes a judge is asked to accept jurisdiction on a matter, and they'll look at it and say, you know what, I may have had jurisdiction. I don't have jurisdiction anymore. That couple in Calgary, they've lived for 10 years in Boise. This isn't mine anymore. You go see a judge down there. Don't flee back up here to Calgary to try and disadvantage your ex-spouse. And sometimes there are conflicts, but that happens not necessarily between foreign countries. That happens between states. And normally it gets resolved by a phone call by at least one of the grown-ups in it. And it usually sorts itself out. But the key is that on the Hague Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support, a foreign country, and the United States already signed us up for it. So it's not like we decided that Idaho went and signed it. We didn't send Butch over there to sign it, or the pro tem or the speaker. President Obama in 2014 signed a bill that passed a Republican House and you get the idea on that. I don't know if it, I think it may have just gone through the Senate, didn't it, Mike, because it was a treaty. And so we're already on the line, and we've agreed to be bound by the terms of it. And any other country that wants to do it has to agree to be bound by those same terms. I am confident that there will continue to be jurisdictional challenges, because there always have been. And I did take conflicts of law in law school, and I've always wanted to have a big conflicts of law case, and I've never had one. But how courts deal with the choice of law, not just the choice of jurisdiction, is also something that's a very nuanced and balanced approach that the courts have wrestled with. We regularly have courts in our state apply the law of foreign jurisdictions because either the parties contracted for it, or that was the relevant law in the circumstance. And a good judge, they can get coached up, they can learn, they're smart people, and they do it. And sometimes they do it right, and sometimes they make a few mistakes. That's why we put appellate judges in black robes, is to kind of clean them up afterwards.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Burgoyne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I know yet whether I have any questions or not, but I've got a couple of things to say. I want to make some comments about the language at the top of page 24 that Senator Davis referred to regarding jurisdiction and modification. That language, beginning on line 2, says, except as otherwise provided in section 71069 Idaho Code, if a foreign country lacks or refuses to exercise jurisdiction to modify its child support order, etc., a tribunal of this state may assume jurisdiction to modify. The right, as I read it, the right of courts in this state to modify a foreign order is limited by some court somewhere having to find that foreign court either lacks jurisdiction or has refused to exercise it. Now, I think that's a problem. It's not a problem we can fix. I am not suggesting here that this bill could go to the amending order and be fixed in some fashion. I get it. The thing I get is we do this or we're just not in the game. But here's something. I mean, this legislation is, to me as a lawyer, just the most fascinating and intellectually challenging piece of work. Courts generally decide their own jurisdiction. This will not tell us which court, the foreign court or our own court, will decide that foreign court doesn't have jurisdiction. This legislation doesn't tell us what constitutes a refusal to exercise jurisdiction. What if we have a Somali immigrant And they're, despite all their problems, they've got an order in Somalia. And somebody's trying to enforce that thing here. And the Somali court gets a motion to modify one of these telephone or Skype-type proceedings. And after hearing the case, after hearing the motion, so it doesn't lack jurisdiction, it's taking jurisdiction and it's considering it, just says, we don't think modification is justified. Is that exercising, is that refusing to exercise jurisdiction? But what if that decision really is unjust? It really is wrong. I don't think we can fix that. I'm willing to vote for this legislation despite that. The justice system is not perfect. We always pat ourselves on the back, say the American justice system is the best in the world. Fact is, there are other countries in the world that have pretty good justice systems. But there are countries in the world that have pretty poor justice systems, and some really not at all. And what's happening here, this is what we're confronted with this bill, in my estimation. What we're confronted with is we no longer sit in the world I was born in, sitting behind two large oceans, secure that our culture and the English language stretched from the Mexico border to somewhere near the North Pole, and that people didn't move to foreign countries very often, and they didn't have these issues very often, and we didn't have to deal with them. We live in a different world now where we have different languages in our own borders and many more people from overseas than maybe we had in the 50s. And we're on this slippery slope. This isn't a matter of not wanting to be on the slippery slope. We are on it. It's where we live. We can't get out of it. I would say we probably don't want to get out of it. But we see every day that Americans around the world are confronting great injustices in foreign countries and even being murdered. And that's the price we're paying for living in this international environment. I think the conclusion I'm coming to is that this legislation is the price we pay for living in this international environment, and we as Americans are not going to shy away from that. But here I also think somebody in this committee has to carry this legislation on the floor, and if it passes, somebody over in the House is going to have to carry it. And the questions that came up today are going to come up on the floor. And I don't feel that I have the ability to explain this bill. I don't think I have the information and the knowledge necessary to do that. There may be somebody on the committee who does, but I think until we do, it would not be prudent for us to put it out on the floor.
Senator Sousa.
Mr. Chairman, would it be appropriate to hold this bill until we have further information about the countries that could possibly be involved and, as Senator Burgoyne suggested, identify someone with the expertise to be able to carry this bill?
That could be a motion, Senator.
Would you like me to make that?
Motions are, you know, the old term, motions are always in order, and that's really true. You can make a motion anytime you would like in
Thank
committee.
You. Mr. Chairman, I would like to move that we hold Senate Bill 1067 to a date to be determined by the Vice Chair.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, we have a motion to hold Senate Bill 1067 to a date to be determined by the Chairman and seconded. Do we have any further discussion, comments? Go ahead, Senator.
I think it's a healthy thing. I don't. There are times that we do have to exercise. There are times that we just have to understand the economic realities. But this isn't the last week of the legislative session with several million dollars on the table. We got a little bit of time to make sure that we do it right. I want people to believe it, to hate the bill as much as I do, and still realize that that when Condoleezza Rice signed the bill on behalf of President Bush, that the prior principles of a prior Uniform Act that dealt with these types of issues, those principles were contained in it. And I think we can get such a person to come and teach us. And frankly, I'd love the lesson.
Senator Tibbetts?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I support the motion to hold the bill to a time certain. It may be necessary, and I may find my way clear to support this, but frankly, I'm not there now. So a request that I would make is, I know there have been times in the past, and I'm going back quite a ways, when I've been told that mandatory language in a bill was absolutely a requirement of federal law, and if it weren't there, we would lose federal funding and so forth. And Candy, I know that you believe that, or you wouldn't have told me that. But I'd like further assurance that's really true. Sometimes when we've gone back and double-checked, we found out that maybe some of the mandatory language wasn't really mandatory after all. So I'd like further discussion on that. And one other item that I'd like to bring up on page 4, this is one of many, and maybe I'm just bringing this up because it's therapeutic if I whine a little bit more about this. But on page 4, we have definition of foreign tribunal. It starts on line 12. And we use this term throughout this bill, foreign tribunal. It means a court, administrative agency, or even a quasi-judicial entity of a foreign country which is authorized to establish, enforce, or modify support orders or to determine parentage of a child. The term includes a competent authority under the convention. I don't know what a competent authority under the convention is, Candy. Maybe you can help me with that later. And maybe we could talk about some of the other concerns that I have. But that's the kind of language that just doesn't make me feel very comfortable when we're saying that courts in this state are going to have to comply with the mandates of quasi-judicial entities in a foreign country or a competent authority under the convention. I don't even know what that is. So I like the motion, and I'll support it and look forward to further discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This has been an interesting discussion to follow. I just kind of have a comment and a short question for the presenter. Throughout this bill, it talks about another state or a foreign country. It's that phrase is all over this bill. And on page 3, down at the bottom of the page, line 46, you define what a foreign country is. And then on page 5, lines 16, 17, 18, you state that outside this state means a location in another state or a country other than the United States, whether or not the country is a foreign country. So I'm a little bit confused there, because when I look at the definition on the bottom of page 3, it tells me what a foreign country is. And then on page 5, it says whether or not the country is a foreign country. And everywhere else in this bill, you're either the United States or you're a foreign country. It's one or the other, or you're a state. So I'm just kind of confused.
Ms. Yearsley?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, as when I bring back the information with whoever I contact about getting it, those words were all the words of the federal government. We did not change those words. They're the words that were, I said earlier, we were verbatim. So we will bring that information back also.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I would have a request as well. I'm very uncomfortable with just parroting language from the federal government into our statute and lining up the commas, as Senator Davis puts it, especially under threat of losing TANF funds. And if you could, I've been searching for it here on my computer on what that amount is, that block grant for TANF is. If you could find out what that number is, and I mean, sometimes the juice isn't worth the squeeze, and that, I'm not saying that's the case here or not, but I think we have to have all the cards on the table to really understand what we're signing up for and why we're signing up for that. So, Kenny, I appreciate your candidness here and letting us debate this bill, and we'll set up another time once, and if you could just be in contact with either, well, with me for okay. Now. And we'll set up another time when we can schedule this once we get all of the pieces in place to have a better discussion.
Excellent.
Thank you. So, we have a motion on the floor
to hold to a date determined as determined by the chair. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries. So we will be seeing this bill again.